Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Birds have long fascinated humans. We marveled at their ability to fly. In fact, the first flying machines humans created emulated their flapping wings. Turns out the ability to fly is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the extraordinary behaviors, adaptations, and intelligence of the species. Jennifer Ackerman's book, The Genius of Birds, brought to light the deep and varied intelligence of birds. She's just published an equally fascinating book highlighting recent scientific research that is dramatically shifting our understanding of birds. The book is The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. Jennifer Ackerman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. So delighted to be here.
I wonder if you would start by reading the last two paragraphs in the introduction.
Absolutely. It's an exciting time to be studying bird behavior. In one arena after another, birds are revealing the secret, sophisticated intelligence underlying their natural and sometimes seemingly unnatural behaviors, and showing us how consistently we have underestimated what's going on in their minds. It's clear that birds are thinking beings, even if they're thinking about different things in different ways than we humans do. Birds are iconoclasts and rule breakers. They destroy our assumptions. They defy our neat categories and tidy unifying theories that try to explain all the mystifying variety under one big umbrella. They blow apart our beliefs about the uniqueness of our own species. Time and again, we humans have claimed that we're the only species with a particular capacity. Toolmaking, reasoning, language-like communication, only to discover that birds share similar abilities. The more we learn about the range of their extraordinary behaviors, the more birds defeat our efforts to pigeonhole them, if you'll excuse the expression.
The genius of birds changed how we view the intelligence and learning capacity of birds, and The Bird Way continues that thread but includes behaviors and adaptations. When you were writing The Genius of Birds, were you already thinking, oh, there's so much more to know about birds, I have to write another book?
Absolutely. The Genius of Birds taught me that there's a pretty wonderful and bottomless body of new research and understanding about birds. And it's just such a thrilling time to be exploring this new bird science.
Yeah. Biologist E.O. Wilson once said, when you've seen one bird, you've not seen them all. The diversity of birds is on par with the diversity of mammals, but most of us have not considered how vastly different they are. Why have birds been overlooked for so long?
Well, I think their intelligence, their mental capabilities have been overlooked because we really misunderstood the bird brain for a very long time. And we thought that bird brains were really so simple that they were only capable of very basic mental processes like instinctive behavior. And it's really been only in the last decade or so that we've come to understand that bird brains may be organized differently from ours, but they're really miracles of miniaturization, dense with neurons, super efficient, and really capable of astonishing mental feats.
Now, in the preface, you talk about the amazing adaptations birds can make and include the bar-headed goose. These birds migrate over the Himalayas where they reach altitudes of 16,000 to 24,000 feet. The oxygen level there is one-half to one-third of what it is at sea level. And these birds are exerting themselves in flight. How do they do it, and how did scientists figure it out?
It's one of the really fascinating stories. First of all, the book does describe some of the physiological variations in birds, which just range enormously. And it was Jessica Meir who studied the bar-headed goose. And, you know, she's an astronaut now, but she was very interested in the extremes that birds go to and how their physiology is adapted to these really extraordinary feats that they do. Now, the bar-headed goose, it crosses the Himalayas twice on its migratory route. So it's flying up at, these extreme altitudes twice in its journeys. And as you said, it's, you know, that the oxygen levels there are very, very thin. And, Jessica Meir was just fascinated by this. Well, she ended up really adopting geese, and she would train them by first riding a bicycle and then a motorcycle, and the geese would just fly along with her shoulder to shoulder. She was training them to fly in a wind tunnel, and that's what she did. And through that research, she learned that these birds are highly adapted to this these very thin oxygen conditions. They have bigger lungs than other birds. They have a special kind of hemoglobin that grabs oxygen more effectively. They have blood capillaries that are really distributed in their muscles, so they can deliver oxygen more effectively. And also, she discovered that this delivery of oxygen is multiplied twofold during their flapping at high altitudes, and they also minimize their metabolic rate, so they actually reduce the amount of oxygen that they need to fly. Just fascinating research, and as she points out herself, we're just beginning to understand this. There's so much more to learn.
Yeah. Now, our understanding of birds has been largely based on the species selected for study and the ornithologists themselves. So how have these two factors shaped and limited our understanding of birds up until now?
Yes, I was fascinated by this. There are two sort of overarching traditions that have been present in the study of birds, and one of them is a kind of geographical bias. Most ornithological research has been done in the temperate zones of Europe and North America, and so a lot of our research is and our understanding of birds is based on bird behavior in these northern temperate zones. But scientists are now beginning to focus more on birds in the tropics and other parts of the world, and they're finding that those behaviors we thought were typical, like migrating, pairing up for short breeding seasons, defending territory mostly through male song, at dawn and dusk, those are no longer necessarily considered the norm. In Australia, for instance, there's a bird called the bell miner that sings all day long. It defends its territory year-round. And a lot of tropical birds breed year-round and often in colonies. So it's a very interesting shift now that's happening in terms of our geographical look at birds. Also, until quite recently, most ornithologists were men. And so there's also a gender bias. Research tended to focus mostly on what male birds were up to, and the part that females played was kind of either downplayed or ignored. One of the really dramatic examples is in birdsong, because it was really thought that males were the only ones that sung complex songs. And again, that was based on this northern temperate region observations. It turns out, though, that in some two-thirds of songbird species, females sing. And they sing songs that are just as complex as male songs, and for similar purposes.
Yeah, I did know this before reading the book, but I don't think everybody knows that birds can have accents as well.
Yes, it's really amazing the regional variations in song and the dialects in bird song and bird calling that vary tremendously from place to place, and sometimes the neighborhoods of dialects are very small and very stark contrast to the next door neighborhood of a different kind of dialect or song.
Yeah, there are two other facts that in the song part of it that really surprised me. One was Australia is where birdsong began.
Yes, it's really an interesting story, and there's a wonderful book called Where Birdsong Began, or Where Song Began, by Tim Lowe, who's an Australian, and he explores this question that we've just really come to understand that songbirds radiated out of Australia many, many millions of years ago, and so our songbirds trace their roots back to Australia, and which really was the birthplace of bird song.
The whipbird's dramatic call, considered such a signature sound of the rainforest, it's used in movies for jungle scenes.
Yeah, it's an amazing sound, and it sounds like one bird. It's this whip-choo, and you think it's one bird making this call, but it's actually a duet between the male and the female, and it is it is so loud and bold, and that's true for so many of the bird songs in Australia. They're just these booming, resonant, amazing songs.
Yeah, and while we're talking about bird song, I think everyone, as you know, who looks at birds and kind of, you know, hears their song and thinks, "What are they saying?" You know, we have the, what do you think they're talking about? And this was a really fascinating part of the book, was just this a communication, taking, for example, strategies for raising alarm. They really do seem to have language.
Yes, they do, and this is fascinating to me. There are examples now from all over the world of alarm calls in birds that contain tremendous amounts of information. Our, you know, common chickadees around here have very complex, evolved alarm calls that indicate not whether a predator is arriving from the land or from the air, and also the magnitude of threat that predator represents. So the number of the little DDDs at the end of its call, those indicate a predator's size and hence the degree of threat that it represents. And what I learned about there's a bird in Australia called the New Holland honey eater that really topples all of our old ideas about how much information a bird can convey in its calls. This bird, when it spots a threat like a hawk, it lets loose with an alarm call that is just packed with information, because it can tell other birds what kind of predator is coming, where it's coming from, how far away it is, how fast it's flying, when the birds should dive for cover, and even when it's safe to come out of hiding again. So, you know, it really makes you wonder what we're missing in other bird calls.
Right.
It's just so cool to me that different species of birds can understand in detail the honey eater's warning message and heed it. So, yeah, birds can understand foreign calls.
Right. And one researcher calls the honey eater's little informants.
Yes, he says wherever she goes, they tell her what's around. And it's very informative.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Jennifer Ackerman about her new book, The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've been talking about the study of birds and how it has changed, but researchers aren't just bringing birds into the lab. They're conducting field research. What are the challenges and opportunities of field research over lab study? And maybe you can give us an example of how field research has expanded our understanding.
It wasn't so long ago that scientists pretty much limited their study of bird intelligence, bird behavior, to the laboratory, because there you can control over your testing conditions, anything that could affect a bird's performance, all the sounds and smells, sights, lighting, temperature, and the presence of other birds. You can control its hunger, its prior experience, all of those things. Now, studying bird intelligence and behavior in the wild is a whole different ball game. Many of the scientists who do this said to me, you know, there's a good reason that researchers study pigeons in the lab. It's just a whole lot. It's a whole lot easier. In the wild, you know, unpredictable things just happen. On the other hand, it's really a vital way of looking at what birds can do, which you can find out in the lab, but actually what they do in when they're faced with ecological challenges in the environment. So it has exploded lately as a field, the study of what's called wild cognition and what are birds actually doing in the wild. And one of the examples that comes to mind right away is the work of Jessica McLaughlin, who She's the one who studies the alarm calls of the New Holland honey eater in Australia. And, you know, she goes out in the field with video and audio recording equipment, and she plays alarm calls, and then she observes and films the responses of the birds. And it's really difficult and demanding work. She spends hundreds of hours doing this. She has to hold absolutely still because the responses of the birds are often very rapid, and she has to catch them on film. And if she moves a little, she's going to disrupt the filming. And she's had some really dramatic encounters with creatures in the field. Like, she was filming one alarm call, and she felt something on her chest. And she said, no, it's okay, it's nothing. And she said, just keep filming. And then she said she felt it move. And she said, no, it's okay, it's just a leaf or something. When she's done the filming, she looks down, and there's a huntsman spider crawling up her chest. And this is a, you know, a big venomous spider as of like a 5-inch leg span. And, you know,
yeah.
throws her hands in the air. And another time, you know, she almost stepped on an eastern brown snake, which is really a deadly creature. So it's it has a lot of challenges. And
yeah, tough job.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I would imagine that technology has obviously has changed. Is that helping us better study and understand bird behavior and adaptation?
Absolutely. We're learning so much through an amazing array of powerful new tools. I mean, we have GPS devices that scientists put in little backpacks on the backs of birds, and they help them track the movements of birds. We have camera traps and high-speed videos that give a really close look at behaviors that normally we can't see, or behaviors that just occur so fast that the human eye can't catch them. You know, things move really rapidly in the bird world. And one of my favorite examples of this is the courtship displays that of mannequins in Central America. They make these really lightning quick acrobatic moves. And there's a scientist at Old Miss, Laney Day, who took a real-time video of the display of the black mannequin. And you look at this video, and it looks like the bird is just hopping up and down. It's very repetitive. It's very simple. But when she took a super high-speed video and then she slowed it down, she discovered something that just makes your jaw drop. Each one of those simple hops is actually a full-body backward somersault the bird does. And it's just too quick for the human eye to see.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Now, you traveled to some amazing places when you were researching the book. Describe how you came up with a list of scientists and species to focus on, and then how you decided what research and species you wanted to see in person.
It's always a challenge, and, you know, I do a lot of legwork in the beginning. I talk to scientists. I spend a lot of time at scientific conferences and at, listening to people delivering papers. That's how I found Jessica McLaughlin. And I consult with people at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You know, what are the interesting stories? What's going on in the field? And then I start to read. And, it's really very idiosyncratic. It's what catches my eye. It's what seems to be revealing the most about the most surprising elements, you know. And I really want to capture people's interest here, not just people who are, you know, already interested in birds, but people with little background. I want to tell really good stories about these birds and just some of the extraordinary things they do and what we're learning about them.
Yeah, and there are so many examples of that in the book. One that really blew me away was the varies predicting weather. And it made me wonder, did they breed early this year? Because we're predicting a good number named storms this year. And I was like, I wonder what the varies did.
Yes, I do too. I have to consult with the scientist who studies them. But it's one of those just mind-boggling things that these birds can
you know, predict a hurricane season with more accuracy than NOAA. You know, we have a lot to learn from them, and it's the female birds who are deciding on their nesting season based on what they've learned, the cues they've picked up from their wintering grounds in South America, and what this indicates about the hurricane season to come.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Now, we've known that many species of birds have keen eyesight. You just think of a bird of prey's ability to spot a small rodent from hundreds of feet in the air, but they see color in a very different way than we do. Explain how birds' color vision is different from ours and how it aids them in foraging, flight, and prey detection.
Yeah, so I spent time with a brilliant young scientist in the field, Cassie Stoddard, who's at Princeton, and she studies the broad-tailed hummingbird, and she's very interested in the way that birds see ultraviolet light. And what she told me is that it's not that they see just a different part of the color spectrum than we do. It's that ultraviolet light is baked into all the colors they see. So it's a whole different imagining of the color experience. Birds are just experiencing the color, different dimensions of color than we are. And she made the analogy of, well, it's like trying to explain to somebody the difference between black and white television and color vision. It's just this order of magnitude of color experience that's so far beyond ours.
Yeah. Scientists are also discovering birds have a far, far keener hearing than we've ever imagined. Share some example of how a robin uses its sense of hearing to find earthworms.
Yeah, this is a fascinating study that, you know, we really do think that birds spot their prey by sight, but robins, you know, they're listening. You can see them on your lawn, cocking their heads. They're listening for earthworms. And the scientists did a study where they created a sort of white noise while the robins were hunting for earthworms, and it really disrupted their success rate. So hearing is a very big factor for them, certainly for owls, too. Owls are very, very tuned into hearing.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with Jennifer Ackerman. Her book is The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. It's not just bats that use echolocation. Tell us about the oil bird.
Just as such a weird bird. It lives in deep caves in tropical South America. And so it spends its days roosting in the blackness of these caves, and it echolocates like a bat. So it has all kinds of special tools that to sort of navigate in this dark world that it inhabits. It has these weird long bristles around its beak, and it uses those for touch sensing. And it also has the most light-sensitive eyes of any vertebrate on Earth. So that helps it get around. But in these deep caves, it is totally dark. So it really needs a guidance system beyond the touch bristles and the light-sensitive eyes. So it echolocates. It emits these audible clicks that bounce off objects and that give it a kind of an auditory map of its really pitch-black surroundings.
Amazing. John James Audubon could be called the grandfather of ornithology in the United States, but even he got some things wrong. Describe the experiments he set up to determine if birds have a sense of smell.
Yeah, he set us down a very wrong path for a very long time. You know, everybody so admired his understanding of birds and his beautiful illustrations, but when it came to his experiments on vultures, for instance, he really did get it wrong. He gave a bird, he laid out a rotting corpse of an animal, and he and this was really a fetid, just awful kind of rotting corpse, and he observed that the turkey vultures, you know, they sort of circled around it, and they didn't come near it. So he was quite sure that they were just spotting their prey by sight. But what he didn't really understand was that turkey vultures like their carcasses to be a little bit fresher than that. So
yeah.
You know, for a very long time, we didn't think that birds had the capacity to smell and at all. And really, since that has only turned around in recent years. And it turns out that, you know, every bird tested has the capacity to detect odors. And, you know, that includes house finches, starlings, quails, and especially turkey vultures and seabirds. You know, mm-hmm. seabirds have this remarkable capacity to suss out their ocean prey through smell alone. So they and they create in their heads these kind of odor maps of whole oceanscapes. So they carry that in their heads. They learn it over time, and they find their krill and other prey solely through smell.
Amazing, isn't it? Let's talk to Anna, who's calling from Edgartown. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I thank you for your show. It's so interesting. I'm calling because I've had these crows flying around all winter, and I decided that I wanted to learn more about them and befriend them because I've heard that they're very intelligent. So I looked it up on the internet, and there's this little thing on how to befriend a crow. And so can you tell me a little bit more? Everybody I tell them that I'm befriending a crow, they go, ugh, you know. But they're wonderful. Seem to be almost like protecting me, and I don't know anything that much about them.
Oh, Anna, you brought up a good point, and that you kind of covered that in your last book, Jennifer, The Intelligence of Crows.
Yes, they are. So they're kind of two genius birds, two families of genius birds in the bird world. They're parrots and corvids. Those are, you know, crows, ravens, jays, magpies. And they're just brilliant, these birds. And crows in particular, I think people have had a lot of experience interacting with them, and you know, one of the wonderful studies that has been done in the Pacific Northwest by John Marsloff is about how crows recognize human faces, and they're very good at this. It's true for Australian magpies as well. They will remember human faces, and if you do something bad to a crow, it will remember you for that. If you do something positive, it will also remember that. So yeah. These birds are holding in mind the faces and associations with faces.
Anna, how long have you been trying to befriend these crows?
Oh, about since March is when they really started coming around. But there was one in particular that always comes, and I put rice out the other day. You know, she's picky, or he's picky. I put out peanuts first, and because I read these things. And then I tried rice, wild rice, and apparently she loved it, or he loved it. And so so I'm trying to bring, you know, because it's so much fun to see them on, you know. Regular birds are all around, you know, but the crow seems to be like this cute thing that is my pet for the winter.
Well, Anna, thanks for sharing your story with us, and good luck. We appreciate the call. We were talking about the sense of smell, particularly in seabirds, and Gabrielle Nevitt was curious about this, right? So they maybe talk a little bit about that tube nose feature of the seabirds that helps them in this way.
Yeah, they have... So there's a whole group of birds called tube-nosed seabirds, and these are the birds that Gabrielle Nevitt studies. And they, you know, they have these cells that they're just loaded with cells that that help the birds detect odors, and they're called nitrile cells. And you know, we knew that rats had them, and that they helped these rats detect smells. But it turns out that seabirds have them as well. And you know, when Gary Nevitt started working to study smell in birds, she was really ridiculed for her work because there was this idea that, you know, that was ridiculous. Birds don't use a sense of smell. And, you know, she stayed with it, and she has made extraordinary discoveries about how sensitive these birds are to smell, and how they, you know, how they grow up with smell in their, really as their dominant sensory experience when they're chicks. And, and you know, these baby birds, they learn their smells when they're very young.
Yeah, explain what she discovered when she looked at maps of DMS plumes across the ocean.
Yeah, so DMS is dimethyl sulfide, and it's a chemical that's generated when krill eat phytoplankton. To our noses, it kind of smells like that, has that seashore smell. It's a little bit like oysters. What she learned is that the birds are attracted to odors like DMS that are released during the kind of, the very vigorous feeding frenzies that go on when krill are devouring their phytoplankton. So the tube-nosed birds pay attention to this, the release of this DMS during those feeding interactions. And one thing that's very interesting to me is that one of the reasons that seabirds eat plastics and other trash in the oceans is that the plastics actually emit this same chemical scent, so they smell like food, and the seabirds are attracted to them.
Yeah, the seabirds see the expanse of the ocean so differently than we do, simply because of their sense of smell. It's just one example, again, of how birds perceive the world so differently than we do.
Absolutely. And, this was another kind of bias that we had. We had this sensory bias, thinking that birds basically sensed the world that we do, that they were primarily visual creatures. And now we're... scientists are really trying to understand how birds perceive the world from the bird's point of view, and it's really revealing some yeah. fascinating new things.
Right. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Jennifer Ackerman. Her new book is The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Larry writes, years ago, while walking a beach with a doctor friend of mine, we watched seagulls drop shells from heights onto the road surface to break the shells open so they could eat the contents. And he asked me, did I think this activity was learned behavior or if it was learned or instinctual. He informed me that he thought it was instinctual. I then told him this story. One of my neighbors who had a love affair with his lawn was trying to protect it from rabbits. He used to put mothballs into a large plastic soda bottle and shake it and then throw it at the rabbits. This method did not work, so he spread the mothballs around various sections of his yard. That also did not work, but the blackbirds would flock in, pick up the mothballs in their beaks, and preen their feathers, roll in them, and then some would pick up the mothballs, fly to a neighbor's yard, where they shared with other blackbirds, I assume to help get rid of any pests they may have. My question is, how did they know how to do this, instinct or learned behavior? And that does kind of have the question, learned behavior versus instinct. Can birds observe and learn from each other? And
absolutely.
Maybe the example of the great tits in Great Britain with the milk jugs would be.
Yeah, you know, birds, they can learn how to solve a problem, learn a new way of doing something from watching another bird do it just once. They have amazing learning capacities. I'm thinking in particular of some of the parrots, the cockatoos, and
Kia, those birds are so smart in this way that they'll just pick something up right away. But other birds as well, you know, I think we really underestimated the capacity for learning in the bird world. You know, you mentioned the great tits with their it's a classic example of social learning in the bird world. You know, some very clever bird learned how to puncture the foil top of the milk bottles that were left on doorsteps in Great Britain, and just they would lap up that lovely cream that collects at the top of the milk bottle. Well, this practice spread all over the UK, one bird learning from another, and you know, pretty much foiled the milk industry in Great Britain until they changed the bottle caps.
Yeah. Let's talk to Vincent, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Vincent.
Good morning. How are you?
Yep, good.
Good. I read Ms. Ackerman's The Genius of Birds a couple of times. Absolutely loved it. Very enlightening as to birds' behavior. Something I never would have guessed. They could do so many things with so much intelligence. But I would like to point out that specifically, I really enjoyed the section about, and I may have the name wrong. I don't have the book in front of me, but the bowerbird with the blue objects, the male building the little hut and placing blue objects in front to attract females. Can you talk about that a little bit, Ms. Ackerman?
I would be delighted to. One of my favorite families of birds, the bowerbirds. Now, I cover the satin bowerbird and the genius of birds, and then I do an exploration of the spotted bowerbird in the new book, The Bird Way. And these birds seem to have an aesthetic sense. They build these bowers, which are little arches or other kinds of structures made of sticks, and then they decorate them, adorn them with an array of colorful or shiny objects. It's basically a kind of, I want to emphasize here, these are not nests. These are more like theaters of seduction because they're designed to lure the female in, and then a male will do a little performance in his bower for the female while she sits in the middle of this little archway. And every species of bowerbird has its own favorite kind of object to collect. So for satin bowerbirds, it's blue objects. You see blue, blue feathers, blue plastic caps, blue pens. They'll take anything they can find that's blue. Spotted bowerbirds like shiny things. And one bower of a spotted bowerbird was built next to the house of a stained glass artist. And the bird had arranged these little shards of stained glass by color, you know, just like a mosaic, really extraordinary. So these birds are, really demonstrating that the bird capacity for aesthetic expression in this very unusual way. I got to see a spotted bowerbird in Australia actually doing its little display for the female, and it was dashing back and forth across its platform and throwing little red objects. It was throwing them in the air, and the female was sitting in there looking at all this, judging it with a highly critical eye, because it's amazing what she's doing is comparing his performance in her mind with other males that she's seen, and only the males that put on the best show or and have the best built bower will she mate with. So, she's being very discriminating and picky about who she mates with.
Mm. Vincent, thanks for the phone call. Jim is giving us a call from Nantucket. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Hello. Good.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
So when the earthworms are squidging around underground, and the robins are hopping around, what is the sound that they make that the robin hears?
You just said it very, very well. They're squidging around, and there's a rustling in the dirt. They're displacing dirt particles. I mean, it's very subtle, but the robins are picking up on it. And remember, they're very near to the ground, so they're able to hear these. And I think, you know, birds that shorebirds that hunt along the coast have a very similar capacity. They can, you know, they can hear some of the scrapings of little mole crabs and things and worms in the sand and go after them that way.
Yeah. Jim, thanks for the question. Go ahead.
If I go out on the grass with my stethoscope and I lie down and I put it on the ground, can I hear the worms?
I would definitely try that. I've never done it, but I think it's a great experiment.
Yeah, Jim, you'll have to let us know how that goes.
I will.
Thanks,
I will.
Thanks for the call.
I'll tell you how many I catch.
Okay. Thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another feat we previously thought unique to humans was the ability to mentally travel forward and backward in time, to remember what happened in the past and use that information to inform our present and future action. There's evidence to suggest birds possess this capacity as well, right?
Yes. You know, one of the first examples of this was with the Western scrub jays, that they could plan ahead in their caching. But the bird that I explore in the Birdway is they're in Costa Rica, these ant birds. And what they do is take advantage of raiding army ants, you know, which flush out insects and other arthropods. And But the ant birds, they're not just scavengers. They're also specialists, and they track the location of multiple ant colonies and share this information with other birds. And they go to the locations of these ant colonies and in the evening after they've already fed in order to track what is going to happen the next day. So it's thinking ahead to breakfast the next morning and where they're going to find it. And as I said, they share this information with other ant birds and other birds that feed at the ant raids. It's really remarkable.
Mm. Now, you write, some say that when our species learned to use fire as a tool to cook, we became truly human. The practice is said to have tripled the brain's processing power. Researchers in Australia are studying whether birds use fire as a tool. Tell us more about the research into black kites.
Yeah, so, you know, scientists have learned a lot lately about how some birds are able to make and use their unsophisticated tools. But these birds, they're called firehawks, and they're different species, black kites, brown falcons, whistling kites. They're showing us that birds may actually use fire as a tool, which we thought was a uniquely human capacity. And, you know, raptors around the world, they often hunt at wildfires. And, you know, they, like the ant raids, they're feasting on the critters that are fleeing the flames. So, you know, little mammals, birds and snakes, those sorts of things. But it's one thing to feed at an already raging fire, and it's quite another one to start a fire yourself. And these Australian raptors seem to be doing just that. They fly into these active fires. They intentionally pick up smoldering sticks, and then they drop them in unburned brush or grass. So they're spreading the flames to new areas. It's really a startling behavior. And again, you know, breaking down yet another barriers that separate humans from other animals.
Yeah. We know that many species of animal play. What bird species are prone to play, and what does that play look like?
Well, one of the most surprising examples to me were ravens. You know, you think of ravens as these sort of somber, dour, very forbidding birds, but it turns out they're among the world's most playful animals. They love to play with snow. You can throw snowballs at them, and they try to catch them. They roll down snowbanks. They love water play. you know, they play in water not to bathe, but just to splash around. One of the examples that I loved was a scientist told me that if you give a raven an empty jar or a flower pot, it will put its head inside just to hear that kind of weird distortions of its own voice. It likes that kind of vocal play too. But so it's funny. The kea parrot of New Zealand is the kind of the king of play in the bird world. This bird plays all the time, you know, tussling, wrestling, throwing things in the air. It spends a big chunk of its time playing.
Well, would you read a passage from a last word, the final chapter of the book?
Yes. Writing this book has changed the way I see birds, given me a new pair of binoculars, so to speak. Just for a day, I'd like to experience the world the way they do, to see leaves with ultraviolet light baked into their greens, to hear and understand the minute musical differences and quick shifts in the acoustic structure of their complex calls and songs. Just for a day, I'd like to smell what a seabird smells. Wake up one morning on the sea with a storm petrel's elevated olfactory sense, and navigate the waters by swirling odor plumes and clouds. As the great essayist Lewis Thomas wrote, smell is a mode of knowing, remarkably like the act of thinking itself. The way birds use their senses offers clues to another kind of knowing.
Now, since all this research that you've done on both of these books, you must look at birds differently. You know, when you're sitting in your backyard and you're watching the cardinal or the blue jay or what have you, you have a different appreciation for what they're doing, right?
I do, both watching them and listening to them. When I learned about the chickadee's vocalizations, it completely changed the way that I hear birds. You know, you think they're just kind of mindlessly chirping away when in fact they're tweeting intelligence to other birds. And now when I walk through the forest, I pay attention to what is happening as I pass, the kinds of changes in the bird calling. And, it has really, really completely overturned how I think about birds. And really, that's my hope for the book, is that people will come to see the birds around them, you know, the crows, jays, tits, wrens, vultures, sparrows, just a little differently, as the really clever and thoughtful and innovative creatures they are, you know, and also to pay attention to usual and unusual behavior in the bird world and what kinds of intelligence might be underlying these behaviors.
Yeah. Jennifer Ackerman's latest book is titled The Bird Way, A New Look at How Birds Talk, Work, Play, Parent, and Think. We'll post a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Jennifer Ackerman, thanks so much for joining us. Always a joy to talk to you.
Such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.